Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and on this edition, as Russia targets Ukraine's energy grid, what will it take to rebuild it? Also, volatility in Brazil's currency as doubts grow about government plans to cut back on expenses. What's behind India's underwhelming growth figures? And 20 years of Yelp, the leading online customer review site. And don't forget, you can contact us on WhatsApp or send us a voice note, +44 330 678 3033. That's +44 330 678 3033. But let's start in Ukraine, which is facing a very difficult winter. Right now, the temperature is already below zero, and the latest missile and drone attacks by Russia have put the entire energy system at risk. More than a million people in Ukraine are currently without power. Well, joining me now is Olga Kakova, who is Deputy Director for European Energy Security at the Atlantic Council's Global Energy Centre. Olga, thanks for being with us. First of all, what is the extent, do we know the extent of the damage so far? Because the system's been hit before. Is it worse this time?
It is the worst winter for Ukraine since the offset of, since the full-scale invasion began in 2022. Ukraine is going into this winter with having lost 11 gigawatts of power due to the destruction by Russia. Russia is currently also going after the heating system, which hasn't been as big of a target before, partially because the transit contract, the natural gas transit contract with Ukraine, is expiring by the end of the year. Therefore, now natural gas and electricity system are under attack. Why is this important during wintertime? Because Ukrainians' heating system is based on natural gas. So seeing millions of people without electricity, seeing hundreds and thousands of people without heat, that's just only the beginning. Ukraine's best strategy for preventing further damage is receiving additional air defense and support in protecting remaining energy infrastructure.
Yeah, because that's obviously the way to stop these attacks, or try and prevent some of them at least. But I suppose, Olga, one of the points is where they're attacking. Are they attacking transmission systems? Are they attacking centers where the energy is produced? How is it working?
All of the above. And this is the scary part ahead of this winter, is that if you recall in 2022, they mostly did go after the interconnections across the electricity system. Then they went after, when I say they, Russians went after the capacity, and they've destroyed, as I mentioned, 11 gigawatts of capacity, mostly thermal power plants. Now Ukraine is running mostly on three remaining nuclear power plants. And not only do they serve as, you know, providers of capacity of energy, but they also serve a really important role for balancing services, maintaining the operations of the electricity grid, which is extremely important as well. And they're also going after the natural gas infrastructure too, and vast natural gas storage that Ukraine has in Western Ukraine. In the past, traders, because it's such a secure system, traders stored gas in that system without any types of insurance guarantees. But Russia intentionally wanted to create risk, mistrust, and discourage traders from saving their gas in that system in the future. So therefore, we're not really seeing a lot of external storage a lot of external traders utilizing Ukraine's natural gas system.
Yeah, because clearly at the moment that would be, in a way, I mean, apart from any humanitarian needs, would actually be economically pretty risky. I suppose, Olga, the other thing with all this is, how much is it going to cost to repair the damage that's already been done? Because money is clearly a factor in all this. There's a lot to be repaired. Is it possible to have an estimate of the costs?
A really rough estimate for a total reconstruction cost is slightly over $500 billion, right? But that's a total cost. But the majority of this will include reconstruction of the energy system. However, just based on even the last couple of weeks of attacks, it is probably significantly underestimated. And comparing apples to oranges too, because Ukraine is aiming to rebuild into a more diversified, more interconnected energy system, a more resilient energy system, so slightly different from the centralized power plants that we've seen in the past. So part of that is also going to be challenging to estimate, but the figures are probably over 500 billion. And this is, again, why the most cost effective, the best strategy to prevent from that figure going up, doubling or tripling for Ukraine is to ensure that Ukraine has sufficient air defense. The allies in the West, both United States and across Europe and other countries supporting Ukraine, have the tools, have the military equipment to provide this to Ukraine. It's just a matter of prioritizing and realizing that these investments, this air defense now, is going to economically help us down the road in minimizing the cost of reconstruction.
But as we sit at the moment, Olga, the situation clearly is that Moscow is intending to damage as far as it can the energy system, because obviously Ukraine is a country that this time of the year is getting colder and colder, and people who have no power, who cannot in a way get enough heat to keep going, are not going to be terribly keen perhaps to continue the war. But how close are we to a point where people are absolutely freezing? Is that really what's going to happen?
That's what Russia is aiming to achieve, is to destroy morale, to literally freeze people out, and mostly the most vulnerable population, the elderly, the disabled, the population that's sick. So that is, these are all number one priorities for Russia. However, we must not underestimate how resilient Ukrainians have been over the last almost 3 years now, over 1,000 days of this horror. And yes, of course, the situation is challenging and people are exhausted. This has been a brutal 1,000 days of living with blackouts, living without heat, basic services. It's extremely challenging. But this also brings up the point that, you know, this is not a war of choice for Ukrainian people. This is a war for surviving. This is not something that they selected to do because they have other options. If Russia wins and overtakes parts of Ukraine, there are significant horrific consequences. We've already seen what happens in Ukrainian cities when they're occupied by Russia, from people being tortured in prisons and to camps and murdered.
Olga, thank you so much for being with us here on World Business Report. That's Olga Kakova, Deputy Director for European Energy Security at the Atlantic Council's Global Energy Center. Now, Brazil's currency, the real, rebounded on Friday from record lows after congressional leaders there said they would put the brakes on government tax income reform. Investors have been rather doubtful about the scope and effectiveness of the measures presented by President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva's administration this week to slow down expenses. Well, our South America correspondent, Ione Wells, is in Sao Paulo. I asked her for the reasons for the currency volatility.
Well, essentially, this is a reaction from the international markets to Brazil's government trying to lower public spending, improve debt in the country, while also sticking to a campaign promise made by the left-wing president Lula da Silva to reduce inequality. On Thursday, the finance minister outlined various measures to try and save hundreds of billions of reais in public spending by 2030. And this included things like changing the minimum wage, but also changing military pensions, changing income tax. In particular, they are now raising the threshold at which people start to pay income tax, which is meant to help the lowest earners, while also raising income tax for higher earners. And essentially, these measures haven't done enough to calm international investors who were nervous about the state of the country's economy, the amount of debt, inflation in the country. And basically, this is the market being a bit spooked, really, by the measures and not really reacting well, which is why people are pulling out investments, hence the currency falling and is now $1 to 6 reais for the first time, which is why this news is quite significant symbolically.
Yeah, I mean, this obviously makes life a lot more difficult, particularly for anyone who has dealings outside the country. What are the governments saying about it?
Well, they say that the measures will help to achieve a zero primary deficit, which essentially means that no deficit before interest payments is a goal for this year and next. The finance minister, Fernando Haddad, says the government will meet this target and that investors, in his words, are basically being too pessimistic and that these measures will help the economy to be sustainable. He has basically said that the market needs to reevaluate what the government's doing and that the market is making a mistake in its kind of assessment of the situation and the actions that he's announced.
But I suppose for ordinary Brazilians, it actually doesn't make much difference, does it, what the value of the real is?
Well, it sort of depends who you are, as you've touched on there, because in terms of the measures announced by the government, this will mean different things for different Brazilians. If you're a lower earning Brazilian, this actually might mean more money in your pocket in terms of lower taxes. If you earn more, this could mean higher taxes for you. But in terms of the currency, essentially, it sort of depends day to day. You know, actually, that might make things sort of, if people have more money in their pockets from lower taxes, it might make spending and people sort of the value of people's money worth more here in Brazil. But if you are buying things that are imported, for example, those things could be more expensive. If you're a business that wants to sell things abroad, that could also prove potentially more difficult. So it does depend a little bit. But I think, as you say, for the average Brazilian, potentially not a huge amount of difference right now, unless you've got dealings overseas.
But obviously, Brazil is a very dominant economy, particularly in that region. I guess other governments around are looking at this and seeing how it might affect them.
That's right, particularly because people are, of course, doing trade with Brazil as sort of the biggest economy of the continent. Interestingly, some investors have sort of made comparisons with other countries like neighbouring Argentina that's also taken actions to try and reduce their debt and inflation. They've done so through much more radical measures with their very sort of libertarian right-wing president, Javier Milei, who has slashed public spending. Some investors effectively saying that they want Brazil to take a more similar approach. But actually, I think this is where the politics comes in, because President Lula da Silva on the left economically couldn't really be more different to somebody like Javier Milei, and hence very different approaches. This, for him, is really about trying to fulfill his promise to reduce inequality, reduce costs for some of the lowest earners who are his sort of voter base. I don't think necessarily politically he minds as much what the markets are saying.
Aimee Wells there, speaking to me from Sao Paulo. So let's have a look at what was going on in the markets. Well, it's the day after Thanksgiving, of course, and Black Friday, in fact, but not a lot of trading on Wall Street. George Conboy, chairman of Brighton Securities, joins me now. George, I mean, it was a thin day, but interestingly, I suppose, looking at the month, which has been pretty good, hasn't it, on Wall Street?
Best month so far this year, Roger. And just a couple of months ago, everyone was projecting the end of the bull market and disaster, and things turn around in a heartbeat here.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, how that works? And is it really to do with, well, I don't know, the election, dare one say?
I think it's a big part of that. When investors around the world look at the U.S. right now, it has become where the world comes to invest. Day after the election, big rally. Rally has continued. If the U.S. voted 50-50 for either side, you don't get a rally that big with half the people in America investing. You don't get a rally that big with no international investors participating. So everyone's participating, or most of them, and that's because the tide has turned to optimism and away from uncertainty.
Interesting, isn't it? And it's interesting, the knock-on effects potentially around the world. I mean, something really interesting has been happening in Japan. You've got the yen rising quite a lot. Now, you and I were talking about earlier in the year, of course, what they call the carry trade moving because of prospects of higher interest rates in Japan and the yen rising on that and all the maneuvers that then have to take place where they're not expecting it, and the dollar weakening. So how are you reading all that?
Well, you've got a 25-year stabilization period after the bubble economy burst in Japan. And everyone's been looking for, at some point, a turnaround. We may see that pendulum start. In fact, we probably already have seen the pendulum start to swing back. And Japan is likely to become a bigger player in international markets with a strengthening of interest rates and the bubble economy being so far behind it. So big plus for Japan. We look for good things there.
But people who've been investing in Japan before on certain assumptions, I guess it throws up a few dilemmas for them.
It does. And the reality is, when you're in early and when it's less certain, you're going to make more money when things go your way.
But do you see Japan continuing in this direction, whatever happens? Because you've got a fairly weak government at the moment there.
You do, but that won't last forever. I mean, think about this. The Trump election seems like it's a bellwether for international turn away from socialism to capitalism. It isn't necessarily so much. Javier Milei did not win the presidency in Argentina because of anything to do with Donald Trump. But we're seeing national economies turning away from socialism to capitalism to save their economies.
Well, it's an interesting analysis, George. Thanks for that. George Conboy there of Brighton Securities. You're listening to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, the cost of coffee is soaring this week. The price of Arabica coffee beans surged to levels not seen since 1977 due to the global supply shortages and adverse weather. Well, my colleague Leanna Byrne has been speaking to Giuseppe Lavazza of the famous Italian coffee family of the same name. Now, he's the great-grandson of the company's founder and the current chairman.
We are in the middle of a big storm, I can say a perfect storm, because the two varieties, Arabica and Robusta, have been hit by this incredible spike in the course of the coffee prices over the last, 4 years. Now we are very close to, records in terms of prices. Today, I don't see any chance that in the next months, the situation can change.
What about in the next years? Do you imagine that coffee prices will ever come down again?
I think not before the second part of 2025. If the climate condition, the crop in Brazil and Vietnam are coming back to normal, and the stock on the coffee exchange are going to grow significantly. Otherwise, I think that speculation will still trying to gain a lot of advantage from this situation and moving the price higher or stay at this level.
The EU is bringing in this deforestation regulation for coffee beans and cocoa beans as well. Do you think that that would also put more pressure on Lavazza, another cost essentially in your supply chain?
Yeah, no doubt. Many producing countries are not ready to be compliant with the strict regulation provided by the European Union. Country where we can buy coffee will be significantly reduced by the regulation. But as you know, we are looking at this with a lot of concern because we totally agree with the purpose of the regulation to protect forests and to protect the biodiversity. This is one of the most important target and challenge that we took up with our foundation and with all the projects we are running through the foundation. But the problem is the burden of a bureaucracy and at the same time, the impossibility to fulfill some of the requirements. It will take a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of investment, infrastructure. The impact on the coffee price will be significant.
Giuseppe Lavazza there. Now, there's been a bit of a slowdown in the Indian economy, the world's fifth biggest. Growth slowed much more than expected in the latest figures. GDP rose, in fact, 5.4% when it was expected to be 6.5%. So what's going on? Well, I've been speaking to the economist Janwani Singh. She's the chief manager at the Export-Import Bank of India. What does she read into these figures?
If you see the finer details, the slowdown has largely been on account of the feeble growth that we have seen in the manufacturing sector. Now, this is something that also aligns with the slowdown in the global manufacturing sector. And if you look at within the manufacturing sectors, if you look at the subsectors, in sectors such as steel and automotive, the growth has largely slowed on account of the higher base in the previous fiscal years. So since the growth was higher in the previous fiscal years, the year-on-year growth rate that you see in these sectors is lower. Also, in some other subsectors, such as petroleum products, the international demand has slowed, and that has also impinged on the growth in these sectors.
That's a worrying situation going forward because, exactly as you say, global supply demand is declining in the manufacturing industry, so that could have a big problem for India in the next few years.
I would just like to highlight here that a lot of the growth in the Indian economy comes from the domestic sector. You know, we are a net importer as far as merchandise exports are concerned. So a lot of our growth comes from the domestic economy itself. And there are good news there. You know, the rural demand has finally started to pick up. And rural demand accounts for nearly half of India's consumption basket. So that has really started to pick up. So there is encouraging news on that front. So yes, global slowdown, definitely it affects the Indian economy. But the key driver of the economy, if you say so, is the domestic economy. So the domestic sentiments actually matter a lot more for the Indian economy than the external sector.
But as you mentioned, the rural sector perhaps is growing, but urban consumers are very important in India. Why do you think they're spending less?
Yes, so in the recent past, what we saw is that there was a lot of pent-up demand after the pandemic, and that led to very robust growths that we saw in the urban sector. And at that point of time, we were not seeing a lot of growth in the rural economy because, you know, the last year, the agriculture sector was hit. So the rural economy, the demand was also quite subdued. But this year, you know, the agriculture has witnessed strong growth, and that is really fueling the rural economy. But on the other hand, the pent-up demand that we were seeing in the urban sector, in the urban areas, is finally starting to taper down. So the growth is moderate. It's not declining in the urban sector, but it is definitely coming down. It's slowing down.
But as you mentioned, the international perspective is important in terms of India's GDP. And of course, we are moving into an era where one of the main trading partners of India, the United States, is talking about quite high tariffs. Is that a worrying factor going forward?
So definitely, the US is an important trading partner for India. There are concerns over higher tariffs, but India and US, if you see the relations, are going strong. And we are collaborating in as part of Quad and other regional arrangements. And there are definitely a lot of concerns in the global economy on account of the tariffs, because if the tariffs increase, it creates a general sense of uncertainty. You know, the uncertainty level goes up in the global economy. And that then has an impact on other economic parameters as well. So there is definitely a concern on account of the growing uncertainties. But as far as tariffs are concerned, currently there are no major signals that indicate any major increase in tariffs for India per se. But definitely the uncertainties going up are definitely a cause of concern, not just for India, but for the global economy as a whole.
What would you expect to be the course of India's GDP going in the next year, say? If we were looking at this time next year, would we see a growth that goes ahead of what's being expected, what's being predicted? Where do you see the direction?
So if you see the high frequency indicators for October itself, there is a steady growth in the economic activity. So the passenger vehicle sales are growing up, rural demand has further strengthened. So going forward, the rest of the year, the sentiment seems strong, and we do expect the economic growth to be strong in the rest of the year. This year, what happened during the first half of the year, the infrastructure expenditures that were being driven by government expenditure had come down. Going forward, that infrastructure expenditure, the CAPEX expenditure, is expected to grow, and that would once again drive India's economic growth. So going forward next year, both infrastructure growth and increase in rural demand is going to bode well for the growth figures.
Chanhanwi Singh there of the Export-Import Bank of India. Now, user reviews are one of the big drivers of commerce in the internet age, and perhaps the most influential of these websites is Yelp. Yelp's just marked its 20th birthday, with almost 300 million reviews worldwide. It's the biggest source for restaurant reviews online. And with so many of us consulting the number of stars a company, a product, or a holiday destination gets, its influence is enormous. Marketplace's Megan McCarthy-Carino reports.
Reviews are everywhere, but only a small share of customers actually take the time to write them. Richard Propes has written more than 1,700.
I think I'm one of the first Yelpers who figured out there was a word limit.
Propes has been a Yelp Elite member in Indianapolis for 11 years. It's a designation for the most prolific and insightful Yelpers. He mostly writes about restaurants, but also doctors and medical services.
Because I am somebody who's a very active wheelchair user, I do kind of feel a responsibility to review as much as I can because, you know, obviously people in wheelchairs want to get out too.
Propes says including accessibility in his assessments is the kind of thing you might not find in your average newspaper restaurant review. He says platforms like Yelp also help to elevate businesses that are off the beaten track, like Futuro Pizza a few miles away, which Luke Tobias started in his own Indianapolis home during the pandemic. He says Yelp was instrumental in communicating with customers and getting their feedback once he moved the operation into an actual restaurant in early 2021.
You couldn't even go into a restaurant at that time.
With a tiny staff and a new baby, Tobias kept limited hours and asked customers to order a day in advance. Still, online reviews helped grow the business.
People started finding out about it, and people started really talking about kind of the quality of the pizza.
This year, Yelp named Futuro the number two pizza place in all of the Midwest. But as soon as online reviews became powerful, even years ago,
it also was very clear that they could be easily faked.
Dina Maislin is a marketing professor at the University of Southern California. She says about 10% of online reviews are fake, and AI tools have made forgeries easier. Yelp, like many platforms, says it uses a combination of user reports and algorithms to detect fake or solicited reviews so they don't factor into a business's star rating. But even when reviews are genuine, they can be pretty noisy to interpret.
You're being lied to by the five-star system.
YouTube star Freddie Wong's advice for finding authentic Chinese food went viral a couple years ago.
Go on Yelp and look for restaurants with 3.5 stars. Exactly 3.5, not 3, not 4. 3.5 stars is the sweet spot for authentic Chinese food.
The formula is based on Wong's theory that cultural differences and expectations can result in reviews being very polarized. A restaurant might have great food, but lack the kind of touchy-feely service many American consumers expect.
Some people think service is very important. For me, I don't care.
The same goes for things like parking, ambiance, or portion sizes. Thus, the sweet spot of 3.5 stars. Lately, though, Wong says he's given up on online reviews.
I would rather have a human being tell me, go to this place. This place is interesting. I trust that more.
But to Richard Propes in Indianapolis, reviews are more than their star ratings.
It's about local. It's about good people figuring out how to make the community better.
His latest five-star review just posted for Luke Tobias's Futuro Pizza.
Megan McCarty Carino there, and I hope you'll give this program perhaps 4 stars, dare one hope. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed it. That's World Business Report from all of us. Bye-bye.